the truth. The whole truth and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, July 26, 2007, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Remembering the McKinney Homeless Assistance Act 20 years after its passage, Cuba a year after Fidel's illness, and conversations with two immigrant women who face deportation. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. This past Sunday was the 20th anniversary of the Stuart B. McKinney Homeless Assistance Act. Named after the Republican Congressman Stuart B. McKinney, the act emphasized emergency measures, transitional measures, and long-term solutions to combat the homelessness crisis. At the time, it was viewed as the first step in a larger effort to eradicate homelessness, but subsequent efforts never materialized. McKinney died of AIDS in 1987 and was a major force on Capitol Hill in advocating for the homeless. He spent the night with homeless residents on the streets of Washington, D.C. soon before his death. The National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty commemorated the anniversary by passing out bittersweet chocolate bars to members of Congress. Joining me on the line this morning from Washington, D.C. is Maria Foscarinis. She is the executive director of the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. She's also one of the primary architects of the McKinney Act. Welcome to Uprising, Maria.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for joining us. First, let's talk about exactly what the McKinney Act actually did to try to address homelessness. What was its goal?
Well, the McKinney Act actually was a first step, a first federal response to addressing the crisis of homelessness, which was just then becoming a crisis across the country. And the McKinney Act really was meant as an emergency first step. Much of the focus of the McKinney Act was on emergency response, on emergency shelters, and on transitional housing, temporary housing. The idea was that this was a first step, and it would be followed by additional steps that would focus on prevention and long-term solutions. But those additional steps never happened. So that was the primary focus of the McKinney Act. It was not the exclusive focus. There are some longer-term measures that were part of the McKinney Act, but by and large, the main focus of the Act and the majority of the money that the Act funded were devoted to emergency solutions.
And what sort of funding is there behind this Act? Over the years, has that funding increased or decreased?
The funding has increased significantly. In the beginning, there was just for the first year, the amount that Congress actually appropriated, that it actually allocated and sent out to states and cities around the country, was $350 million. And that has increased to the point where it's now over $1.4 billion. So the funding has increased significantly, but it's still far below the amount that's needed to address even the emergency needs of homeless people. These are not large numbers in the scheme of the federal budget, and especially if you consider these numbers against the background of all of the cuts that have happened over the past 20 years in social welfare programs, in particular the cuts to federal housing programs for low-income people, these amounts are not nearly enough to make up the difference. They're just a fraction of that difference.
I'm looking at an editorial by a homeless advocate with the Western Regional Advocacy Project, Paul Bowden, who wrote earlier this month in the San Francisco Chronicle. He basically says that the federal government since 1979 has reduced subsidized affordable housing by $52 billion. So we're talking about losses here in affordable housing of $52 billion, and this act today has a funding of $1.4 billion behind it.
Right,
certainly
exactly.
Doesn't sound right.
Exactly. Hmm. So it's a very, that's why we are calling this anniversary a bittersweet one, because the funding that the Act and the provisions in the Act are very important ones. At the time that this law was first passed 20 years ago, it really was a watershed. 20 years ago, as I said, homelessness was just beginning to be a national crisis. It was a time when the country was still shocked by the fact that people were sleeping on the streets, that families were without shelter, that kids were without shelter, that they were without housing. And getting Congress to actually take action was a big step. It was also the time when President Reagan was in office, when he was stating publicly that homelessness was simply a matter of choice, that certainly it was not a matter for a federal government response. So getting this federal response was important. It was important recognition of federal responsibility. And it has made a difference in the lives of the people that it has helped. It's helped people transition out of homelessness. It's helped people stay alive while they're homeless. It's helped children get into school, because one of the provisions that is a longer-term one in the original Act had to do with school access for homeless kids. It's required vacant federal buildings and property to be converted into, to be made available for advocates and providers to use to help homeless people. In fact, I just learned that a property in L.A. has just opened that uses abandoned federal property to serve homeless and low-income people. So these are important accomplishments, and they really demonstrate to us that homelessness can be solved, that solutions can be put in place, that Congress can help end homelessness. But they're not on the scale that we need. Even just considered as emergency measures, the federal government itself recently estimated that about half of the homeless population nationally doesn't have access even to emergency shelter. So even on their own terms, these provisions are insufficient. But if we're really if our goal is to end and prevent homelessness, then we've really got to be concerned about low-income housing, which is a critical component to ending and preventing homelessness. And there the cuts have been massive. So much more needs to be done, and it has to address not just emergency needs, but the longer-term solutions and the holes in the anti-poverty programs that have been created over these past years.
My guest is Maria Foscarinis. She is the executive director of the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. We're talking about the McKinney Homeless Assistance Act, which was passed 20 years ago this month. Now, does it seem to you, Maria, that the passage of this act in a way has been used as an excuse by Congress to not have to do any more on homelessness because of this act, which is significant and has some significant funding, that that basically Congress has turned a blind eye towards any future or follow-up programs?
I think that that may be the case, and I think that is often the case, especially with social welfare programs.
So there's an attitude of, we're already doing something about this problem, we don't need to do any more.
Exactly. That as soon as a solution is put, or some kind of response is put into place, then we move on. Then Congress moves on. Then the public in some way, or the media, moves on. I mean, this is a kind of short attention span, and it's a lack of follow-through that I think is very real. And that's why I think it's important to call attention to this anniversary. And we were very pleased that we did get a response from Congress, and members of Congress joined us to speak about the anniversary when we had our event commemorating it a week ago with all of our colleague organizations. We had important members of Congress, including Congresswoman Maxine Waters, who is head of the Housing Committee, as you know, in the House, and we had Representative Chris Shays, a key ranking member of Congress on the Housing Committee, speak about the need for additional steps and recognize that the McKinney Act was just a first step and Congress needs to do more. Mm. So that's our goal as advocates, and that's that's our charge, really, is to hold Congress accountable and say, look, you addressed this, but you didn't finish, and we need to finish the job.
Finally, Maria, what about the candidates who are vying for next year's presidency? You know, there's a lot of issues that are often talked about, including the war and other issues. Is homelessness a major issue for these candidates? And if not, what is your organization doing to try to get presidential candidates to address this issue?
Well, it's not a major issue now. And I guess with the exception of John Edwards, the candidates really have not spoken about poverty as a major issue in general. And I think one of our next challenges is to really raise the profile of the issue of homelessness and the larger issues of poverty with the candidates and hold them accountable for what they will do if they're elected.
Well, Maria Foscarinis, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Where can listeners find out more about your organization?
On our website, which is nlchp.org, National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, nlchp.org.
And actually, very briefly, before we go there, is there any new piece of legislation that Congress is at least considering as a follow-up to the McKinney Act?
There are a number of pieces of legislation. In the House is the Hearth Act, sponsored by Representative Julia Carson, which would reauthorize the McKinney Act and also make some expansions and improvements to it. And there's a similar piece of legislation in the Senate, sponsored by Senator Reid. We are working together with our partners on additional legislation, including the Bringing America Home Act, which is set to be reintroduced, which is a much larger piece of legislation and addresses the longer-term needs.
And that information is on your website as well?
Yes.
Okay, and that website is nlchp.org. Maria, thanks so much for joining us
today.
Well,
thank you very much.
Maria Foscarinis is the Executive Director of the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, whose website is at nlchp.org. She's also one of the primary architects of the McKinney Act, which we've just been discussing. The McKinney Act was passed 20 years ago, one of the first major pieces of legislation to address the issue of homelessness. You are listening to Uprising. Later in the hour, we'll be speaking with a woman who is currently taking sanctuary at a church in Long Beach. She faces deportation. We'll also hear an interview with a Filipino nanny who faces deportation and this week's peace vigil announcements. After this music break, we'll hear about what's happening in Cuba 1 year after Fidel Castro got sick. And we'll also hear this radical day in history. And by the way, tomorrow on Uprising, we're going to be joined live in studio by Michael Eric Dyson once more. He is the author of Debating Race, and his new book, Know What I Mean, is just out. He's going to be speaking this evening at 7 p.m. at SO1 Books at 4331 Degnan Boulevard in Los Angeles. That's this evening, July 26th at 7 p.m. at SO1 Books, Michael Eric Dyson. And if you missed the event, certainly tune into Uprising tomorrow. We'll be right back.
As basic as the roof over your head, as basic as food, this essential is new.
Deadline LA, I'm Howard Bloom.
And I'm Barbara Osborne.
Every Saturday at noon, you can hear Deadline LA, KPFK's local media analysis show. That's every Saturday at 12 p.m.
So you want to avoid clothes made in sweatshops. Well, your shopping just got more complicated.
People! People, the time's come.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, July 26, in 1953, Cuban revolutionaries Fidel and Raul Castro led an unsuccessful attack on the Moncada barracks in Santiago de Cuba. The attack was an attempt to overthrow Cuban President Batista, who consistently protected U.S. interests at the expense of the Cuban people. Upon his release from prison, Castro joined forces with Che Guevara in Mexico and organized the 26th of July movement to liberate Cuba. After peaceful resistance tactics failed, Castro and Che resorted to armed guerrilla warfare, successfully overthrowing Batista in 1959. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Say it.
El Moncada nos mostró el camino a recorrer y desde aquel alto ejemplo para nosotros siempre 26.
Siempre 26. Welcome back to Uprising. The Granma International newspaper of Cuba reported yesterday that Raul Castro would give the public address at the annual celebration of the July 26th Moncada Barracks assault of 1953. This major annual Cuban event has usually been presided over by Fidel Castro. In fact, Fidel Castro's last public appearance was exactly a year ago today for last year's Moncada celebration. 5 days after that appearance, Castro underwent surgery for an undisclosed medical condition and, in an unprecedented move, temporarily ceded power to his brother Raul. Fidel has missed every major Cuban event since his initial surgery, including the funeral of Raul's wife, Vilma Espín. Cuban exiles have been largely disappointed, however, over the past year the structures of the Cuban Revolution have remained intact, without major reforms or political uprisings. Some U.S.-based Cuba analysts speculate that Raul Castro would have implemented reforms if Fidel had left the scene. However, Fidel has assumed a presence through his essays entitled Reflections of a Commander-in-Chief. His political future and the future of the Cuban Revolution remain a question yet to be answered. Joining us this morning to try to answer that is Sujata Fernandez. She's an assistant professor of sociology at Queens College and author of the book Cuba Represent, Cuban Arts, State Power, and the Making of a New Revolutionary Cultures. Welcome to Uprising, Sujata.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So is it significant that it's been a year now that Fidel has not made any major public addresses in Cuba? We're seeing his brother take on a task that he traditionally and, in fact, always has taken on since he's been in power. Is it significant that today, on this very important anniversary in Cuba, he is not going to be doing this public address?
I don't think it's that significant. I think what we're seeing take place is a kind of gradual and moderate transition to people kind of accepting that Fidel has moved out of the public spotlight, that Raul is now the one who will be doing the important addresses, who will be sort of taking the head of the nation. And the absence of Fidel, I think, is in some ways trying to reinforce that transition that in many ways has already happened.
Now, let's talk about this past year and the role that Fidel Castro has played in his essays. He has certainly, I think, tried to maintain a symbolic presence. What has the effect of that been within Cuba?
I think that it has, as you noted earlier, the fact that there have been not really many signs of tension or conflict or dissent. I think that Fidel's kind of gradual removal from the scene while continuing to give his commentary, while continuing to make sort of these, you know, small appearances here and there, and by his commentary, really does show that, I think that is having an effect in the sense that people are not, you know, that there wasn't the radical break where, you know, with either the death of Fidel or his sudden removal from the political scene that people feared might lead to more political upheaval. I think that what we're seeing is just this kind of moderate removal, and in that sense, he does maintain. I mean, people have always said that Cuba's a kind of consultative democracy, that Fidel, from when he first came to power in 59, was always, you know, talking to the people, was always going to schools, was always going to hospitals. There was this sense of this sort of popular plebiscite every time he appeared. And I think that the Cuban political leadership is unwilling to sort of completely remove that, because they realize that, you know, although Fidel is not the Cuban Revolution, that aspect of consultative democracy still plays some kind of role in the functioning of the system.
Now, if there has not been the major upheaval that some expected in Cuba over the past year, does that mean that the dissent within Cuba of the structures of the revolution is pretty insignificant, or are people simply biding their time?
I think that's really hard to say, and, you know, many, many people have tried to make predictions over ever since the Soviet Union collapsed. People have tried to make predictions about what would happen, and, you know, most have said, well, just this is going to happen, then the system will collapse, or this will happen, and then the system will collapse, and they've all been wrong because it hasn't collapsed. And my sense is because there's a much greater sort of appreciation of what the Cuban Revolution has achieved among ordinary Cuban citizens, and there's also a system of values associated with socialism about the importance of collectivism, about the importance of solidarity, and many other values that I feel are a really important part of Cuban society and culture, much deeper than, say, the United States government would be willing to admit. And that, in its sense, has provided a sense of coherence and continuity among Cubans. So I think it's really hard to say what will happen. There's also, precisely because of this high level of support for the revolution, there's been a low level of dissent. And, you know, it's also been argued, well, there's a low level of dissent because Cuba exports its dissenters, that they go to Miami or they go outside. And I think to some extent that's true, that people who are part of the opposition have not been able to establish much of a base within Cuba, and so they do it from the outside, which really reduces their credibility within Cuba if they're, you know, in Miami or another place. So, I mean, I think all of those factors have led to what we've seen in this sort of very calm kind of year, you know, as Fidel has extracted himself from the political situation. And to me, that's really what's playing an important role, the fact of what the revolution itself really means to Cubans.
I'm speaking with Sujata Fernandez, assistant professor of sociology at Queen's College. She's written the book Cuba Represent, Cuban Arts, State Power, and the Making of New Revolutionary Cultures. So let's talk about Raul Castro and what he represents. His role this past year, some have characterized as simply the role of a caretaker in place of Fidel, you know, simply trying to continue what Fidel's policy has been, but really not playing his own leadership role within a Cuban government. Would you concur with that?
Yes, no, I mean, I think that's definitely true. And as you said earlier, I think some people believe that Raul is just biding his time, waiting until Fidel goes to make a more switch to a China-style market economy. And, you know, he is in some ways a mysterious figure because, you know, people say, well, he's this kind of military man as compared to Fidel, who had, you know, the much more open relationship with the people. He also doesn't tend to give the long speeches that Fidel gives. He's much more practical and to the point. And, given that those facts, I think that it is true he has played this kind of caretaker role. He has presided over a transition which has not only meant a sort of transference of power from Fidel to Raul, but a more broad transference from Fidel to a collective leadership, which involves other people like Vice President Carlos Lage and Foreign Minister Felipe Perez Roque and others who have in some ways taken up the slack and have begun to collectively assume some of these tasks. And I think that that in some way that transition has been quite seamless, and that Raul really has played an important role in managing that transition. And so beyond that, I'm not really sure what to say. I think the only thing I can say is with Raul is that I think there'll be more continuity in what he does, regardless of, you know, what happens with Fidel. I think in his actions, I think we're going to see more continuity rather than a kind of dramatic change.
Mm-hmm. Taking a broad view, Sujata, how much of the durability of the revolution do you think has relied on Fidel's leadership style, his charisma, and his sheer force of personality?
I think it can't be denied that quite a large proportion of the popularity of the revolution among ordinary Cubans has, you know, depended on the charismatic figure of Fidel. And you know, I remember just being in Cuba and sitting with an old man who was watching these old pictures of Fidel, and he just had tears in his eyes as he was watching him. And I think that it's a very, very emotional thing, particularly for people who remember those early years of the revolution. And, you know, and as I was talking about before, this kind of style he has of consultative democracy, of going to the people and, you know, going to just appearing at a school. I have a friend who told me, oh, when I was in, you know, when I was 7 years old and in school, Fidel turned up at my school one day and he started coming to the playground, asking us what we thought about, you know, our school. And so there's this role that he does that he's always played. And so I think that That it's not, you can't deny that that Fidel has really played an important role. Nevertheless, it has been surprising to a lot of U.S. observers who've always maintained that, you know, Fidel is the only reason that the Cuban Revolution exists, and the minute you take out the man, you know, every structure will you know, just collapse. And the fact that that hasn't happened, I think, shows that there is some sustainability to the institutions that were established under the revolution, and perhaps some ability to perpetuate themselves even in his absence.
Now, you said that there is certainly an emotional aspect to it, particularly among those who remember the revolution. But what about among the youth? You've written a book that you know, focuses on new revolutionary cultures in Cuba. How do Cuban youth view the revolution under Fidel, and do they have a different outlook for the future compared to their parents and grandparents?
I think that they do. I think that there's not the same kind of revolutionary euphoria that, you know, among young people as you see among an older generation, or there's not the same kind of understanding of what the revolution means. But nevertheless, the revolution has bequeathed them an education. It's bequeathed them a sort of understanding of social rights, you know, that you don't see in necessarily in other parts of Latin America, that this sense that, you know, among Cuban rappers, for instance, and that's mainly who I've worked among, you see this sense that, you know, we have increasing racism in Cuban society because of tourism, because of economic crisis. You have all these problems emerging, but the government has to fix them because these are our rights. Now, in many other parts of Latin America, with the crisis of the state under neoliberalism, you've had this abandonment of the idea that the state should even do anything, and, you know, you just rely on your own resources in the urban context. Whereas in Cuba, there's still among young people a very strong sense that, you know, that the government has the obligation to actually make sure that the poorest and the most vulnerable in society are still cared for. And just the framing of many rap songs is really interesting to me, in that you can see the legacy of the revolution among young people, and, you know, and that how that will play out, I'm really not sure of. I mean, you're seeing much more political forms like rap music gradually replaced by reggaeton, and you're seeing, you know, the migration out of Cuba of a lot of rap musicians who were fundamental in creating the movement in the early 90s, and so that doesn't necessarily bode well for the future of some of these movements. But there are people who are continuing to stay in Cuba, and I think that, you know, another movement I looked at was visual arts, and looking at the young people coming out of the schools, the art schools, and just, you know, the kinds of ways that they want to engage in their society, doing public act, you know, not interested in art in an art gallery, but wanting to take to the streets and do street art and engage with people through public performances and comment, critical commentary on their society. And so I think in a whole lot of ways, young people really are building these new revolutionary cultures that is trying to take the legacy of how they were brought up, but deployed in a critical way. I mean, there's no telling how the current Cuban leadership may take Cuba. They may take them down the road of what happened to the Soviet Union. And I think that young people and artists really are acting as the critical voice to ensure that, you know, that social justice continues to be an important part of whatever kind of transition takes place in Cuba.
Sujatha, what has the U.S. been doing in this past year regarding Cuba? What is the Bush administration's thinking been on Cuba, either publicly or through any policy documents that you might have been able to track down in preparation for what they see as the end of Castro, Fidel Castro's regime?
Well, I think that they are keeping their eye very closely on what is unfolding. They have surprisingly not, other than continuing to provide funds to dissident organizations, and they provided a lot of money. I'm not sure if it's been more or less, but they have provided a lot of money, continuing funds to dissident organizations. You know, they've also released policy statements saying things like, you know, we want to promote freedom of Cubans, we want to, you know, all of this kind of thing. We've also seen at the same time, you know, all these reports, CNN, on the sort of one-year anniversary of Fidel's illness has also come out with a report just recently where they said, you know, Cubans are longing for the day when they can buy cellular phones and computers and cars. And so there's, on many fronts, I think that the U.S. government is looking for any way that they can destabilize the situation there. But, you know, I think that they're also recognizing that the time is not ripe for them to do anything beyond that, because you know, the sort of uprisings in the streets that I think they were hoping for has just not happened. And so their reaction has been a lot more muted than they possibly thought it would be.
Finally, Sujatha, was last year's appearance by Fidel Castro at the Moncada celebration, do you think that is basically going to be his last public appearance for good?
It's really hard to say because, you know, nobody really knows what the situation with his health is. And to me, you know, I have a feeling that it possibly is, given that he hasn't made any public appearances since then. And other than writing, we haven't really heard too much about his health situation. So it may well be the last time that we heard from him.
Well, Sujatha, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Sujatha Fernandez is Assistant Professor of Sociology at Queen's College. She's the author of the book Cuba Represent, Cuban Arts, State Power, and the Making of New Revolutionary Cultures. We've been talking about Cuba and Fidel Castro a year, exactly a year, after Fidel Castro made his last public appearance before he took ill and ceded power to his brother, Raul Castro. Raul will be giving the address tonight at the in Cuba for the Moncada celebrations. Today is July 26th, the annual event, the anniversary of the 1953 Moncada Barracks event that marked the beginning of the Cuban Revolution. You are listening to Uprising, and after this week's peace vigil announcements, we'll hear from two immigrant women who faced deportation from the United States. Stay tuned.
Son ventanas abiertas a la realidad. Quisiera que fueran más, que fueran las puertas que conducen a la felicidad. La carta de libertad esperada por presos inocentes. La alegría que da paso a una sonrisa. Quisiera que fuera la brisa que sopla cuando todo esté en paz. El sol que en invierno calienta a los desvalidos, que fue el olvido de motivos que mantienen vivo dolores ocasionados por malas acciones o decepciones, que fueran los honores a un soldado muerto en guerra. Quisiera que fuera paz sobre la faz de la tierra, que mi mensaje fuera fuerte, que llegara a conmoverte y que mi pluma fuera espada que desafía la muerte. Quisiera decir tantas palabras que no puedo.
It's time for our weekly peace vigil announcements. I'm Gabriel San Roman. Neighborhood activists all over Southern California hold regular peace vigils to end the war in Iraq. Each week we announce just some of the 50-plus vigils that are taking place. Complete listings of all the vigils are available at www.neighborsforpeaceandjustice.org or www.peacevigils.com. On Fridays in Claremont from 4:30 to 6 p.m., there's a peace vigil on the corner of Indian Hill Boulevard and Arrow Highway. The information line is 909-399-3451, or you can call 909-621-5811. On Fridays in Montrose from 5:30 to 7 p.m., there's a peace vigil on the corner of Ocean View and Honolulu Boulevard. The information line is 818-248-8151. Again, that's 818-248-8151. On Fridays in Topanga, there's a peace vigil from 5 to 6:30 p.m., on Topanga Canyon Boulevard between PCH and Ventura Boulevard at the Pine Tree Shops. The information line is 310-455-2688. Again, that's 310-455-2688. On Saturdays in Burbank, there's a peace vigil from 8 to 10 a.m. at the Farmers Market in Burbank. The information line is 818-842-5055. Again, that's 818-842-5055. On the first Sunday of each month in Woodland Hills, there's a peace vigil from 5 to 6 p.m. on the corner of Topanga and Oxnard Boulevards. The email contact is renelancon@aol.com. That's renelancon@aol.com. On Wednesdays in El Sereno, there's a peace vigil from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at Eastern and Huntington Drive. The information line is 323-257-1443. Again, that's 323-257-1443. Finally, on Wednesdays in Long Beach from 6 to 7 p.m., there is a peace vigil on the corner of Broadway and Long Beach Boulevard. The email contact is codepinkLB@yahoo.com. Again, that's codepinklb@yahoo.com. A complete list of vigils is available at www.neighborsforpeaceandjustice.org or www.peacevigils.com. And a very special last thank you to Susanna Faith.
Welcome back to Uprising. Since 1996, more than 4,000 Filipinos have been deported from the United States. Following the 9/11 attacks, the rate of deportations has dramatically increased. More recently, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, has systematically targeted immigrant communities across the country through mass raids that have resulted in Filipino immigrants being deported alongside many other immigrant communities. As a result, the number of deportations have jumped from 400 a year to 800 a year, making Filipinos the most deported of all Asian ethnicities. A nanny who goes by the name of Flor is among those who faces removal from the United States. Upon her arrival to the East Coast, Flor had started her job in childcare as a way to assist her family members back home. After receiving notice that her appeals to remain in the country have been rejected, she could be deported. KPFK reporter Leilani Albano spoke with Flor about her situation.
Well, in the first place, I came here to have a brighter future for myself and for my pamangkin back home. Mayroon akong kapatid na single mother who has two kids who I love very much, and I thought na they will not have a bright future. And I was a teacher there, and it's barely enough to live by yung sweldo mo. So, and I had a close relative who invited me to come. So sabi ko, I will give myself a chance. So luckily, I'm a nanny right now.
How much money were you making like in a month? And how much were you making a month here as compared to the Philippines as a teacher?
10,000 pesos is roughly $200. Per month. So that's less than $200 a month for assistant principal level. And now I'm receiving almost like $2,000 a month.
Okay. So, I mean, it just makes sense for you at least on a financial level then to stick it out here.
Yeah, I'm actually more than anything else, I would really like those children back home to have a brighter future for them. And also for me, because so maybe it's about time that I give myself a chance to save money for my old age because I didn't have savings.
And you did not want to perhaps get an employer to sponsor you?
Nobody guided me. I mean, I was so naive. I mean, admittedly, I was really so naive. I didn't know what I was doing when I came here. Nobody guided me what to do, you know, so...
Do you ever think about your former life?
Yes, I do, because I feel that I'm fulfilled there because I can do openly what I want to do, volunteer in this group and that group, environment, human rights, or special children, and you're free. And now you cannot do anything here openly. So the fulfillment and meaning of life, where is that? Yeah, and I just realized that, you know, I mean, I'm talking about the plight of people like me. I mean, having come from a family-oriented culture, you know, I cannot even visit my relatives here now in the U.S. because I'm scared.
So then how do you fill your times, your days, especially around holidays?
Oh, of course, that's the toughest part, especially Christmas, you know. I don't know if I'm the only one, but I talk to other people, even other races, Hispanics, non-Hispanics, because I talk to people who are in the same, you know, situation. But they always feel depressed. And I raise these kids like my own. So, but sometimes I tell my boss that I get depressed over my situation, and she understands somehow.
And now they are proposing this bill, which will cut off family reunification. The backlog will be longer. What is your feeling about this bill?
I don't know why all of these restrictions. I don't really know why. I couldn't understand their psyche, the reason behind their why do they resist or why do they make it hard? Are they scared or what?
I mean, the fact that they're going to cut off family reunification is a direct hit on the Asian and Latino cultures, because they know very well that that's where that is at the heart of why we're here. So if they can break it, they can break, you know, this whole immigrant movement.
Okay, so, one second. But where did they come from in the first place? Saan ba sila galing? Dito ba sila pinanganak? Yung kaninunuhan nila? They came from Europe. Aren't they immigrant themselves?
And for a while, there were no restrictions on immigration.
That's what I'm saying. So why come the restrictions now?
Were you the kind of person that believed in the American dream? And if you are that person, do you still believe in it?
I don't really know exactly what they mean by American dream. It's just that for me, a brighter future for oneself is the American dream, I believe. And maybe that's not even an American dream, it's my own dream. Well, if they will listen to their hearts and really, you know, be open to other people coming into this country whose purpose is to pursue that dream, then there's probably hope. But if they use their reasons or their minds without listening to their hearts, then I don't think there's hope.
And that is an interview with Floor, a Filipino nanny who does face deportation. The interview was conducted by KPFK reporter Leilani Albano. You are listening to Uprising, and we're going to turn next to a similar story. This past May, immigration enforcement agents arrived at the home of an undocumented Oxnard woman in order to deport her. The woman, who goes by the name Liliana, has a husband and three children who are all U.S. citizens. Liliana was ordered to report to a detention center within 5 days of the house visit to prepare for her deportation. The deportation order stems from 1998, when Liliana attempted to use a forged birth certificate to enter the U.S. Faced with a dilemma of family separation, she sought sanctuary in congregations throughout Ventura County, but no congregations in the immediate area had joined the newly emerging sanctuary movement in her time of need. But a Catholic deacon and his wife offered to shelter Liliana and her infant son. She stayed with the couple for 3 weeks before finding sanctuary far from home at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Long Beach. For nearly 2 months, Liliana and her son have lived in a converted church office building, while the rest of her family comes to visit on weekends. A church much closer to home in Simi Valley recently voted to become a sanctuary congregation and may eventually house Liliana as she fights to stay in the United States with her family. Liliana joins us on the line this morning. Also with us is Cindy Villanueva. She is the bilingual secretary at St. Luke's Episcopal Church. And in studio with us, Angela Tilen, our volunteer Spanish to English interpreter. I'd like to first welcome Liliana to Uprising.
Bienvenida, Liliana, al programa de radio Uprising.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much.
Liliana, let me ask you first, what has your life been like over the past 2 months while you've been staying at St. Luke's Episcopal Church?
Liliana, déjeme preguntarle primero, ¿cómo ha sido su vida en los últimos 2 meses en los cuales usted ha residido en la Iglesia Episcopal de San Lucas en Long Beach?
Mi vida ha cambiado totalmente.
My life has changed totally. I never expected to be a refugee in a church. My children, mostly I miss. It is very difficult to be without them. I only have with me my little infant baby. Sometimes I feel sad, but sometimes I encourage myself because I'm doing this for them.
Cindy, tell us about this new sanctuary movement that St. Luke's is a part of.
This sanctuary movement, above everything, is just to protect the justice of humanity. We believe that is keeping a family together is very valuable, and to separate them is more of a crime than anything else. And more than anything, we're here to protect her and offer any services that we can.
Is Liliana the first to be offered sanctuary?
In the United States, no. There's a woman in sanctuary in Chicago which she has been there almost a year. There's other small sanctuary movements around the area that have been going around for a small period of time, but no, she's not the first, but she's one of the first, and definitely many of them have families that they don't want to leave behind.
I want to turn back to Liliana. How do you respond to those who say that you broke the law when you came initially to the country, and now that you've been caught, you should pay the price?
Liliana, ¿cómo respondería ustedes a aquellas personas que dicen que usted quebrantó la ley cuando llegó aquí e inicialmente no cumplió y que ahora quiere ser amparada por la ley?
Okay, mi respuesta sería,
my answer would be,
siento que no estoy quebrando la ley.
I believe that I am not going against the law.
Quebrar la ley, el querer separar
they
una familia.
Feel, don't they think that it would be even worse que, to go against the law to separate
la ley,
a family
yo pienso que lo principal
than to break the law?
Es la familia.
I think that what matters most is family.
Siento que no estoy quebrando la
and
ley,
I believe that not, not going against the law because I've always have sustained this. I am not a criminal.
Liliana, what sort of situation, what is your current situation right now, and how long do you plan to stay at the church?
Liliana, ¿cuál es su situación actual y cuánto tiempo piensa usted permanecer en la iglesia?
El tiempo que sea necesario para
whatever
estar
time
con mis hijos
is
para
necessary so I can reunite
mami,
with my children. They tell me,
ver.
Mom, continue fighting. I try to explain to them,
ellos.
Writing them a letter so they would know what this is all about.
I want to turn back to Cindy Villanueva. You are the bilingual secretary at the St. Luke's Episcopal Church, where Liliana is currently there and is being offered sanctuary. I understand that the Minuteman Project have targeted your church because of this. Can you tell us what they've been doing and how people have been countering their protests?
Well, visually, there has been a few manifestations outside the church, and though it is bothersome, they do not intimidate us at all. We do receive many anonymous emails and calls that are just very, for lack of a better word, disgusting and offensive and unnecessary. And we do not deal with those people in the sense that we do nothing against them. Our only interest is to be peaceful, to offer sanctuary. However, since you did mention a counter protest or something like that, this Saturday we have been receiving news that an organization called Save Our State will come and protest against Liliana. And once more, it's very racially oriented. It's just very offensive. And this time we decided to kind of just counter-protest outside the church also this Saturday from 10 to 12 in a very peaceful manner, just being there for her and supporting her. And anybody that wants to come and just be with us and share this moment with us is more than welcome, because we're not going to go down to their level and just be like them and offend others just because they feel like it.
So the counter-protest today will be, or rather on Saturday, okay, will be from 10 a.m. to 12 at St. Luke's Church in Long Beach. What's the address of the church?
The address is 525 East 7th Street, Long Beach, California.
That's 525 East 7th Street. I want to turn back to Liliana. What has the effect on your family been during your time at the church and ever since the visit by ICE?
Liliana, quería preguntarle cuál efecto ha tenido sobre su familia, su permanencia en la iglesia después de la visita de esta ICE, este programa. Well, my children, most of all, are the most affected ones. They do not understand, why am I here? They ask me, what is the difference with the fact that I was born in Mexico and that they were born here?
They don't understand the difference. I try to explain to them. Sometimes they seem to get it. Other times they feel nostalgic and they say, we just don't understand. Just please come home, Mom. Mostly, they have been the most affected ones.
What about your husband?
¿Y su esposo?
Mi esposo,
well,
también,
my husband,
me da mucha tristeza con
also,
él
I feel very sad about him
trabajos,
because he has
no
two jobs. He doesn't spend much time with the children. He works nonstop to pay the bills, the rent, everything that has to do with the household. So I feel very sad towards him because sometimes he has to take care of them, and sometimes if I call him at 11 p.m. and I ask him, what are you doing? Well, washing, even after his second job. For me, that situation of his is very sad.
Liliana, what sort of help do you hope to receive from people outside the church, even from immigrant rights advocates?
Liliana, ¿qué tipo de ayuda tiene usted la esperanza de recibir de la gente, aun cuando sean de que no pertenecientes a la iglesia, en cuanto a los derechos de inmigración?
Un apoyo de amnistía.
An amnesty support is what I expect.
And what do you hope will happen in the next few weeks and days? You know, what happens if the Immigration and Customs Enforcement comes to the church?
¿Y qué espera usted que suceda en los próximos días, en las próximas semanas, cuando la unidad de inmigración, los oficiales de inmigración viniesen a la iglesia?
Como si ellos fueran a venir a la iglesia.
Like if they come here to the church?
Yes, exactly.
Sí, exactamente, si llegan a la iglesia.
Okay, la iglesia ha preparado un plan.
Well, the church has prepared a plan.
CLU ha preparado un plan.
CLU has prepared a plan. They do have the right to enter the church to get me. I will not resist, but if they're going to take me, they have to take me because my baby is only 4 months old and totally depends on me. So if they're going to take me, they will take me with my baby. There are telephone numbers that are activated that will, so when ICE comes to the church, the media can get in touch through these numbers set up at the church.
Finally, for Cindy, can you give our listeners any more information on, on the church plan or on support that you expect from people who are in the immigrant rights movement?
We expect from people that are in the immigrant rights movement their support, and they have been showing it. More people are getting involved in the sanctuary movement.
Only have about 30 seconds. Do you have a phone number?
Yes, I do. Directly, I don't have it, but I just want everybody to tell them to come Saturday from 10 to 12 and be here for us.
Again, the counter-protest is this Saturday from 10 a.m. to 12 noon at St. Luke's Church in Long Beach at 525 East 7th Street. By the way, there's also going to be a protest on Friday at 5:30 p.m. at the Downtown Federal Building against the ongoing ICE raids. Thank you very much, Liliana, for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And also thanks very much to Cindy Villanueva, who's the bilingual secretary at St. Luke's Episcopal Church. And as always, thanks so much to you, Angela Thielen.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Uprising. For Sonali, subversive thought for the day, I'd like to quote Raul Grijalva, who once said, "We cannot shun our values as an immigration nation. This is a wrong path. And while possibly it is a short-term political victory based on division and based on creating a wedge issue that splits people in this country, it is a long-term defeat for this nation." That's Raul Grijalva, and that's Sonali, subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Tamika Zogi is engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's program after 10 a.m. on our website, which is linked through kpfk.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks for listening.